In recent years, popular writers on religion and interfaith relations have often said that all the world's religions are really the same underneath. They're just different paths to the same God. Now, it can be comforting to believe that we're all the same, but according to Stephen Prothero, it's just not true. And downplaying differences can be dangerous. He makes his case in a provocative new book called God is Not One, The Eight Rival Religions That Run the World and Why Their Differences Matter. Stephen, leaders in interfaith relations have tried for decades to emphasize the commonalities among the world's religions, and you want to focus on the differences. Why in the world do you want to do that?
Well, because it's true. Because I don't think ignorance is ever the way to go. I think that the idea that all religions are essentially the same, that they're just different paths up the same mountain, ignores the fundamental differences in doctrine, mythology, ritual, and practice that ordinary religious people know are there. And I think we need to start with the practice of ordinary people rather than with the sort of high-flown theories or the mystical experiences of elites.
Mm. Now, why does it matter whether we focus on similarities or differences? How important is religion in today's world, in your estimation?
Well, the world is a furiously religious place. Religion is incredibly important. This is a place where we do agree, all the pundits writing about religion, right? We have the new atheists who are saying religion is this horrible thing, it's poison, and it's ruining our world. And then we have the kind of liberal multiculturalist perennialists who are saying religion is this wonderful thing, it's true, and it's beautiful. The thing that both sides agree on is that religion matters, that religion is important, that religion is powerful. Is religion the greatest evil in the world? Is religion the greatest good? I think it's both. And I think that's why we need to see it in a clear-eyed way, not through the ideologies of all religions are true or through the new atheism of all religions are false, but how it really is on the ground.
Now, in your book, you say that the idea of seeing all religions as one is a lovely sentiment, but dangerous, disrespectful, and untrue. When does this universalism become dangerous?
Well, I think it's dangerous in a lot of ways. I think it's dangerous because ignorance is always dangerous. I think if you take some examples, for example, why do we go into Iraq as the United States military? We go in there in part because we imagine that Muslims in Iraq are pretty much basically just like us. They want the same sort of things that we want. They see the world in the same sort of way. If we hold out democracy to them, they'll want it in the same way that Christians in America want it. Similarly, just as we don't see the differences between Islam and Christianity, we don't see the differences inside Islam when we look at Iraq and imagine going to war there. We don't see that there's Sunni and Shia. We don't imagine that if Hussein is gone, that all of a sudden we're going to have civil war between these two religious factions. Why don't we see that? Well, in part because we imagine that there really isn't any essential difference between Sunni and Shia. There isn't really any essential difference between Muslims and Christians. I think the world is divided not only over politics, not only over economics, but also over religion. And we can't understand the big hot spots in the world, whether they're the Middle East or Sri Lanka or Kashmir, without knowing something about the religious differences that divide us.
And knowing them harkens back to your previous book called Religious Literacy, where you said we need simply to know a lot more about the world's faith traditions.
Right. I mean, we have, you know, this point was made by the Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of State under Bill Clinton in her book, The Mighty and the Almighty. She said, when I was Secretary of State, 24/7, I could call up dozens, hundreds of economic and political experts, but I had no one to go to for religion. So when she wants to figure out, like, what's going on with religion in Afghanistan, what is she going to do? She's going to Google it or something. She doesn't have anybody to talk to. Now, this only makes sense if the world basically runs on greed and power. In other words, if humans are basically political and economic animals. But what if we're also religious animals, which we are? Then we need to understand religion, and we need to understand the similarities that we have, but we also need to understand the differences. We need to see the religious world as it really is.
Now, not long ago, the renowned religious scholar Karen Armstrong was a guest on this show, and she was discussing her new Charter for Compassion, with which I'm sure you're familiar. Let's hear a clip from that interview.
each of the world religions, without exception, has developed its own version of the golden rule. Don't do to others what you would not like them to do to you. And say that this, again, is what brings us into relation with what we call God, Nirvana, Brahman or Tao. And so the Charter for Compassion is an initiative, a global initiative worldwide, to bring compassion back to the center of religious and moral life.
Now, in fairness to her, she acknowledges differences, but she seems distressed that many religious leaders dwell on those differences. And she believes that the ethic of compassion is actually at the heart of all religions and is seeking to give it new life. How do you assess that idea?
I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong. I think she's right that all religions preach compassion. I think she's right that all religions preach the golden rule. Mm-hmm. This is the low-hanging fruit in interreligious dialogue. I mean, obviously, religions don't tell us, you know, push your mother into the road, have sex with your brother, you know, kill your son. I mean, this is a no-brainer. So the question then is, and this is why in interreligious dialogue, it's such a cliche to run to ethics, right? A group of people get together, interreligious dialogue. What do they come up with at the end? They come up with a statement that says we should love one another. They never come up with a statement about how many gods there are, because they don't agree, whether Jesus is the Son of God, whether Jesus is the Savior, whether we're trying for salvation, whatever it is. They can't do that. Why? Because the only arena they agree on is ethics, is compassion. The question then becomes, is this arena of agreement, which I agree is an arena of agreement, is it the heart of religion or not? I totally and absolutely disagree. No religion says, except for maybe Confucianism, says that ethics is the heart of religion. Ethics is part of religion, but it's not the heart of religion. Did Jesus come and die on the cross in order to tell us to be nice to one another? No, he didn't need to do that. We already had Judaism that told us that. We already had, as Karen Armstrong argues, Confucianism to tell us that. Why would God up in heaven think I need to come into the world to make to say this cliche thing that everybody already knows exists? Why does Allah get recitations from God through Gabriel? To tell us to be nice to one another? No. To tell us that we have forgotten that there is one God to whom we must submit. This is where I think the elision or the erasure of disagreement is so dangerous, that the religions are not at their heart about compassion. And it's to misunderstand them to say that. Hmm. I also think hidden inside this idea is a disdain for ritual. I think that when we run to ethics, when we run to the interior life and say, what religion is really trying to do is change our hearts so that we're nice to one another, there's implied a polemic against ritual, that the Confucians are wrong for their emphasis on ritual, the Jews are wrong for their emphasis on ritual, and the Catholics, the tradition in which Karen Armstrong was raised, mm-hmm. are wrong for their emphasis on ritual. Ritual is a part of religion, and in many traditions it lies at the heart of religion, mm-hmm. closer, I think, than compassion.
It's clear in your book that, you know, that you favor good interfaith relations and dialogue, but I'm wondering how you would define the interfaith movement and what you think its goals ought to be.
Well, I think its goals should not be bargaining to agreement. We've had enough of that, and the bargain to agreement always comes up with the same thing, the golden rule and compassion.
And in your book, you talk about an older model of interfaith dialogue and then a newer one, and Ibu Patel, who runs the Interfaith Youth Corps, is an example of that. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, he's kind of my hero.
Ah.
I mean, he's my hero because he's an example of how to do interfaith dialogue without pretend pluralism. He is able to get Orthodox Jews, Evangelical Christians, and Muslims in the same room. How is he able to do that? Well, he's able to do that in part because he focuses on action. He says, we're going to get together and we're going to build a house today for homeless people. We're going to serve soup in a soup kitchen. Feel free to talk about your religions, but don't talk maybe about God. And like maybe talk about service. Like talk about why you're here. You know, and get to say like, well, I'm a Jew. I believe in repairing the world. Tikkun Olam. I think that's why I'm doing here. I'm a Christian. Jesus says, blessed are the poor. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a Muslim, that we have a preferential option for the poor in Islam. It's one of our core values. And so he says, let's get together and let the dialogue be kind of accidental and ad hoc. Let's not have a big conference table. Let's have a soup kitchen. And he is able to get a lot of different groups in the room. Now, that's one model. It's not the only model. But I think the key is if dialogue can't get Orthodox Jews and evangelical Christians and Muslims in the same room together, then it's not really dialogue. It's more monologue.